Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You may never have heard of rare earth elements, but they're a big deal. They're a critical element in cell phones, lasers, computer hard drives, motors. They're vital for smart bombs and nearly every aspect of green technology, from hybrid cars to solar panels. And China has essentially cornered the global supply. Rare earth elements are a huge lever to move the world economy or hold it hostage. Japan just got that message. Now the U.S. is waking up. This hour on Point, we're waking up to the incredible story of rare earth elements and who's got them. You can join the conversation. Are you tuned in to rare earth elements, their significance, their power? Are they in your pocket right now? You're in your cell phone. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We go first today to China, which has very deliberately a corner on 95-97% of rare earth elements in the world, and recently gave Japan a sharp little lesson in power politics. Peter Ford joins us from Anhui Province in China. He's Beijing Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Peter, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom. Nice to talk to you again.
So China and Japan got into a kind of a diplomatic tussle over some little islands offshore. Japan's Coast Guard boats had bumped up with the Chinese fishing vessel. They got into a tussle over letting the captain of that fishing vessel free. And Japan says, Peter, that China was threatening to put its foot on Japan's supply of rare earth minerals. What do we know about that?
Well, it's rather a confused situation. The Chinese deny absolutely that there was any sort of embargo on rare earth exports to Japan. But that certainly does seem to have been an effective suspension for several days of shipments of rare earths from China to Japan. What slightly confuses the picture is that the Chinese have decided they're going to limit their worldwide exports of rare earths. And around about the middle of September, when this whole thing blew up, they were approaching the end of their annual quotas anyway. But the Japanese say that it was fairly clear that the Chinese were sending them an economic message that if you want these rare earths, which, of course, as you say, are critical to a lot of Japanese high-tech industry, you'd better do as we want you to do in the dispute. And indeed, Japanese did. It only took about 48 hours before the Japanese authorities decided that they would release the trawler captain whom they'd been holding for 10 days. It also came in the wake of the arrest of four Japanese citizens in China who were effectively hostages, although the Japanese government denied there was any particular connection between the two events.
Just the thought of rare earth elements embargoed and Japan folded in a big hurry. Where in China are these elements, Peter?
Well, they're mostly up in the northeast, and they're actually quite a lot probably in Mongolia. Not just in Mongolia, Chinese in Mongolia, but the sovereign state of Mongolia. And they're not actually necessarily that rare. I mean, they're known as rare earth.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese have such a grip on the market as much because of the fact that in the rest of the world they have not been economically viable to mine, and they're also environmentally not very friendly. But the Australians and the United States, indeed in California, there are very large reserves, but mines in California closed in the past because they just weren't commanding good enough prices. Now, I think the Chinese will probably find that what they did to Japan, even though it lasted only a few days, has attracted such attention around the world and raised such doubts about whether or not China might again use its economic power for diplomatic purposes, that maybe Japan, that China will not be controlling 95% of these resources for very much longer.
But it's not easy for others to gear up. Just quickly, Peter, how Deng Xiaoping, the famous leader of China who turned it toward its version of capitalism, you know, decades ago now, saw this very early on, that rare earth elements would be a significant resource for China. Talk even of a China as the kind of OPEC of rare earth elements. How did the Chinese see it that early?
Well, it depends how far ahead you were looking, and Deng Xiaoping was, of course, a particularly foresightful statesman. What I think is particularly interesting about the fact that that you bring up Deng Xiaoping was that his great dictum in terms of foreign affairs was basically hide your light, move slowly, move softly, do not show your power. And this is a dictum that the Chinese have followed with great success for the last 30 years or so, but now very much appear to be moving away from. Beijing has been a great deal more assertive in its foreign policy over the last 12 months or so than we have been used to seeing it. And I think it's also raising a number of hackles, not just in Japan, but in other neighboring countries in the region.
Hide your light, don't show your power, but the power of a corner on the world market on rare earth elements shining very bright right now. Peter Ford in Anhui Province, China. Thank you very much for joining us, Peter.
You're welcome.
Peter Ford, Beijing Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. With me now in the studio is Anthony Mariano. He's a geologist and world-renowned expert on rare earth elements. Has 50 years experience working with rare earths in the lab and in the field across many continents. He serves on the advisory boards of several rare earth-related companies. The mineral Marianoite was named in his honor in 2008. Anthony Mariano, thanks for being here.
Oh,
we're really glad to have you.
Thank you,
right
you
here.
Tom.
So, I mean, a lot of people had never heard of these. You spent your life working with these. Why are rare earth elements so important? Why is suddenly everybody talking about who's got them?
Well, as already been mentioned, they are essential in many of the high technology that we depend on today. Cell phones, computers, hybrid automobiles, wind turbines, they're very important in defense systems, in missile guidance and control. So they have, and as phosphorus, they have multiple applications, and their properties are relatively unique and probably not replaceable.
And that list, I mean, it's an incredible list. It goes on and on, from solar panel glass, I guess, to the wind turbines, a lot of green energy, 25 pounds of rare earth elements, I read, in every Toyota Prius. They're in self-cleaning ovens and lasers and nuclear batteries and important in mercury vapor lamps and neutron capture, whatever that is, X-ray tubes, X-ray machines, high-temperature superconductors. What is it about these elements that sets them apart from other elements? Without losing us here, can you explain what makes them so potent?
Well, their electronic configuration, I'm not a chemist, but the valence electrons for the rare earth elements are suborbital electrons, which imparts special properties that are not replaceable by other elements.
Particularly in the area of magnetism and magnetics, they're really important.
Yes, they are used. Neodymium and samarium are used in high field strength permanent magnets that replace conventional magnets that we have been using for so many years. They're much stronger and they're much smaller.
Irreplaceable. For many countries, they're now kind of like the unobtainium in Avatar, not because they're not around the world, but because, as Peter Ford was saying, from China, it became economically not viable to mine them. But that happened for a reason, because China was mining them so much more cheaply than anyone else was.
Exactly. Exactly. They have the resources, and their cost of mining is very low. We cannot, at this time, compete with that. And they are environmentally tolerant.
China is tolerant of the very high environmental cost that goes into
the impact that it has on the environment
is pretty severe, in part because, as I understand it, these elements, while they're relatively common, they're widely dispersed, so you've got to go through a lot of earth to pull them out.
Well, to give you an idea, the South China clays, they control the heavy rare earth elements. The heavy rare earth elements include terbium through lutetium.
The most important ones
heaviest,
of all these rare earths.
Yes, and yttrium. And what you have is very weakly attached rare earths on clays. And the average content of total rare earths and yttrium in the South China clays is even less than 0.1 weight percent.
So you've got to go through 1,000, is that 1,000 or 10,000 times?
Yes, and so you end up, once you've extracted the rare earths, and they can be removed with ease because they're so weakly attached.
But you're chewing up a lot of landscape to do that.
And you've moved a tremendous amount of earth that totally affects the surrounding countryside and the rivers nearby.
You've seen the clay areas and also in the north, in Inner Mongolia. Can you tell from what you saw in China just how important these are to China, from what you physically saw there?
They're very important to China. And China's been aware of this for a long time, and they did precisely what Peter Ford mentioned, that they walked very quietly moving into this, and they indeed want to control the rare earth market on a world level. They want to be totally in control of that.
But if any country does that, they control the leading edge of technology on a global level.
Well, as far as acquiring the resources that are used in the leading technology, yes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about rare earth elements, China's hold on the world market, and what rare earth means for everything from cell phones and hybrid cars to war. Anthony Mariano is with us. He's a world-renowned geologist, has worked all over the planet on rare earth metals. You've got a question. He's probably got an answer. And here's a Facebook comment from Eduardo. Says, the race is over. China already has a near-complete monopoly, and just in time, too. Just as the world is trying to move away from oil, it seems we'll be trading one cartel for another, though I don't know if it's a cartel, if it's one country. Joining us right now from Washington is Christine Parthamore, fellow at the Center for New American Security. She directs the National Security Project there, specializes in natural resources and how they affect national security and foreign policy. Christine Parthamore, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
How do you describe to people just sort of tuning into rare earth elements how important they are, Christine?
They're very important. Overall, we're seeing that across the board, natural resources are playing a generally growing role in security and foreign policy affairs. Everything from water to minerals, oil and energy, we already know. What's unique about rare earths from the defense point of view is that they lack substitutes. There are a lot of applications for them, such as permanent magnets and jet engines, that there's just no viable substitute for. So for a lot of minerals, the United States is 100% import dependent, or only a few countries in the world produce them. But it's that critical component of it that that rare earths are irreplaceable in a lot of defense applications that makes them particularly worrisome for the United States.
Let's look at those for a second. It goes way beyond that. And interesting, it goes all the way from, you know, bombs to very green technology. But I'm reading here, this is in Bloomberg reporting, that they one thing they do is help direct smart bombs like Raytheon missiles. Do you know how they do that, Christine? Why are they important for that? My understanding is it's something about the magnets in the fins, in effect, of these missiles, so that they can be directed in very subtly with this very light little application of rare earths. If you didn't have that, you'd have to put in hydraulic pumps and all the rest.
Yes, but this gets to part of the problem that we have, and that's that we don't exactly know a lot of exactly how rare earths are used and how important they are in certain applications is proprietary by the companies that make them, or it's on the classified level because of the nature of some of these weapons and systems. So we in the public don't necessarily know exactly how these are used. But what's even more important is that the Department of Defense doesn't even necessarily know. Congress about a year ago mandated the Department of Defense inventory how it uses rare earths in all of its weapons systems, in all of its defense supply chains. Because even the Department of Defense, given the private nature of its supply chains and the global nature of those chains in some cases, doesn't even know exactly how it uses and the full extent to which it's dependent on rare earths.
They target smart bombs. They silence the whoosh of Boeing helicopter blades. They target the guns of General Dynamics tanks. And you say, Christine, until very recently, people didn't even know what the supply chain was. They didn't know where it came from, though we essentially know it all comes from China.
Yes, and some of it comes through through equipment that we procure from NATO partners. Some of it we purchase directly from China. Some of it comes through equipment from that the Japanese produce. But basically, even the Department of Defense doesn't know. They're still in the early stages of identifying just the full extent of what these applications are.
There's the manufacturing side, and there's the mining side. Anthony, Tony Mariano, I mean, these were mined in the United States. In fact, we were the leading source of rare earth elements for quite a while. What happened to that?
Well, we obtained the light rare earth elements from the Mountain Pass mine operated by Molycorp in the early 50s.
And this is in California?
In California. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the most important of the rare earths was europium-3+, which was used in color to give the reds to televisions.
Color television.
Phosphors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. And there were multi-application of various rare earth elements. But at Mountain Pass, they are concentrated in the light rare earth elements from lanthanum through gadolinium.
Mm-hmm.
And they acquired small amounts of heavy rare earth elements from a mine, from residual fluids that were derived from mining uranium in Blind River in Ontario, Canada. And they also purchased small amounts of an yttrium phosphate mineral that is enriched in the heavy rare earths mm-hmm. from Indonesia, Thailand, mm-hmm. and Malaysia mm-hmm. in small quantities.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, the world rare earth source came from Molycorp and came from Rhone Poulenc.
Molycorp, which was American.
American, mm-hmm. and Rhone Poulenc, a French company, mm-hmm. and they acquired their rare earths mostly from beach sands in Australia, in South Africa, in Brazil, in India, various places.
Why did those sources basically go away?
A couple of reasons. The mineral monazite is mm-hmm. A light rare earth phosphate that is found in beach sands, and it was taken to France where Rhone Poulenc processed it. But that monazite was running very high in thorium, and the French government then felt that they were just bringing in too much
thorium, which was poison,
into the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so they switched to the mineral bastnasite, which is a rare earth fluorocarbonate that exists in Bayanobo, in Inner Mongolia, mm-hmm. in China. And because of the costs of producing, and again, the fact that environmental problems are not being addressed to, were not.
In China, they just let it roll, yeah.
So they could provide the marketplace with rare earths on a much cheaper level than Molycorp at Mountain Pass, California.
And down that went. I mean, essentially, the U.S. produces almost none now. Same with Australia. They're trying to crank up again. I mean, Christine, I mean, the bottom line here looks like China undercut everybody's prices and was willing to take the hit on the extreme environmental damage that can come in mining out these rare earth elements, Christine.
Yes, they were. They made a decision that it was important for their strategic position in the economy and how they wanted to position themselves for the future in manufacturing and mining, that they, you know, were willing to take the environmental harm that does these. But I tell you, the Chinese are starting to care a lot more about the environment. They're starting to consider it and talk about the environmental effects of some of their mining and other practices more. Not because necessarily that they're going to turn back and develop more environmentally safe practices, but that they, I think it's in part telegraphing to the world that they are destroying some of their country to supply these, that they are really harming their own environment in ways that could affect their own people to provide these. It's an important aspect of it that I actually appreciate them highlighting in the global press and things.
Well, and that is absolutely true. There's no doubt about it. But I have to say, what's really going on there has been very widely interpreted in another way, not as an environmental move alone, certainly, but as a way of cornering the market. China has clamped down on its exports, and increasingly, companies who do this very high-end manufacturing feel I'm reading here in The Economist magazine, they have to move their operations to China to be assured of a supply of rare earth elements. It's a maybe an environmental policy, Christine, but it's also a way to get all of this manufacturing under the Chinese arm.
Absolutely. It's for the most part, it's an economic move. But that said, it's very important not to ignore the security and foreign policy implications of it, even though it began and sort of originated as an economic decision on the part of China.
I mean, I'm reading here about China coming into Indiana a few years back and just, you know, buying out American companies that did this manufacturing. And before you know it, the same stuff was going on in China and was not going on here. Evan Bai pretty upset about that. Let's go to our callers, Zachary in Lancaster, South Carolina. Zachary, you're on the air.
Yes. I had a question. First off, Mr. Ashworks, thank you for having me on the program. It's an honor. I was doing a little research last year, and I understood that China actually flooded the market, like you guys were talking about, in the early 90s. And I guess my question is this seems like a consolidation, and it seems like a gradual process. I'd like to understand how it's like this secret, and they've held their cards back. How exactly did they go about the process of concealing what would, to me, seem like a fairly in the open and a large-scale operation?
It's a good question. And to look at it from the other side, it seems like somebody was asleep at the switch in this country. I mean, again, I'm quoting here from Bloomberg, but they went to just one factory, Zachary, just to give one example. This was a brick factory in Elm Street in Valparaiso, Indiana, once made 80% of the rare earth magnets in laser-guided U.S. smart bombs. 2003, the plant's owner shifted the work to China. And now that factory in Indiana is a doggy daycare center. It's a doggy daycare center, and the technology's gone to China. I mean, Tony Mariano, you worked with Molycorp, the big, I mean, you still do, you advise them. They must have seen this going on when they were shutting their production down. It was all going to China. It's not like, yes, China was quiet about it, but it wasn't a secret.
I think they were pretty slow at seeing this. And the thing that they could, again, not compete with is the cost of producing, the labor costs, the energy costs, the reagent costs in China being much lower than what is required in the United States to produce the same rare earth elements. And they were, unfortunately, environmental problems came up in the state of California. They were accused of polluting the groundwater going into
serious.
The Ivanpah Valley.
Yep.
And so on that basis, there was just no way that they could compete with the Chinese as far as selling. Just the cost of transportation of their ore was greater than the cost of purchasing from China.
But Christine, if Deng Xiaoping in his dotage in the 1980s could see that this was vital, and he said so, he laid it right out, you know, there's OPEC for oil and China will be the rare earth power. If he could see that, what was going on with American manufacturers, miners, national security strategists?
Well, I mean, as you said, we were a little bit asleep on it here. It's not that China went about doing this in a highly secretive manner. You know, they've established rare earth, you know, towns, basically, in China, centered on this industry. It's no secret to the world that they've been doing this at all, and they have not gone about it in a clandestine fashion in any way. We don't have a good handle in the United States here as defense policy analysts of what the raw materials are in our defense supply chain and how to watch for these warning signs that a country is cornering the market in a way that might be able to provide them leverage in a tight foreign policy bind like Japan was in last week, or when it's just that critical to our defense supply needs that we need to be either stockpiling or making sure that we have diplomacy centered on ensuring the smooth operation of these supply chains. We don't have a good framework for understanding how to watch for when these things are going to become problematic for
us. That's a very gentle way of describing what's going on here. I mean, now I'm reading it. Space.com, they say there are rare earth metals elements, probably, on the moon. We're ending our moon program. China's starting its. Let's go to Niagara Falls, New York. And Mark, you're on.
Yeah, I've heard of these before.
in the 70s, like that gadolinium, I think it was, that they were, one of your guests was talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, Tony Mariano's nodding. Yeah, yeah, so?
Supposed to, one of our national laboratories developed a refrigerator that was 30% more efficient than the best possible refrigerator available in the 70s anyway.
Okay.
But having said that, I don't know why they're called rare if they're in Australia. Are they rare like gold or diamonds?
Why are they called rare? I mean, partly it's just, Mark will pick it up, partly the French first named them and they used the word rare. It's become the name. But why rare? I mean, they're in North America, they're in China, obviously, they're in Malaysia, you were saying, maybe all over the place. Tony?
The term rare earth is a misnomer. As a matter of fact, the two rarest of the rare earths are thulium and lutetium, and they're about 200 times more abundant in the Earth's crust than gold.
But they're spread out all over the place, and it's not a misnomer in the sense that China's got almost all of it, so it's rare for everybody else.
No, there are numerous resources in other parts of the world.
Well, China has, what, 36%? In the U.S., 13%. But mined and above ground and ready to use, we have none at this point that we produce here. Am I right?
Well, we Molycorp is probably going to be going online again in the near distant future.
Near distant?
Yeah, well,
you can't do it overnight, right?
Perhaps in a short term.
Mm-hmm.
And they will provide the light lanthanides. And we have resources in North America and in South America and in Europe for the heavy lanthanides. It may be more expensive to produce them,
mm-hmm.
but the heavy lanthanides, for the most part, come from the iron adsorbed clays in China.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they, again, they are causing in great environmental problems. And so we should be able to function independent of China in acquiring the heavy lanthanides. And again, as I mentioned, they are most valued at this time. And there are individuals and companies that are very busy doing exploration for deposits in North America and even in Europe that should be able to compete with the heavy lanthanides from the South China clays.
And compete on cost of production.
Yes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about rare earth elements, China's big hold on the world market, and what rare earth means for everything from cell phones and hybrid cars to war. Anthony Mariano, geologist, is with me in the studio. He has had feet on the ground all over the world where rare earth is. 97% plus now, the supply comes out of China, and they've demonstrated recently their readiness to use it for a tough advantage with Japan, just for one. Christine Parthamore is with us from the Center for New American Security in Washington, D.C. Looking at a couple of things here. One, here's the GAO, the Government Accounting Office, looking at two rare earth projects outside China scheduled to ramp back up by the end of 2012. One, Molycorp, which Tony Mariano has talked about. Another by the Lynas Corporation in Australia. The GAO says it may take 15 years to rebuild a U.S. manufacturing supply chain. In the meantime, analysis that China is using its control of supplies to leverage that high-end manufacturing back into China. Here's Peter Leitner, senior strategic trade advisor at the Defense Department. Until 2007, he says, the Pentagon has been incredibly negligent. There are plenty of early warning signs that China will use its leverage over these materials as a weapon. Tom in Omaha, Nebraska. You're on the air, Tom.
My question is, we've been talking a lot about the front end of the process as you mine and generate these things. We haven't talked much about the back end of the process, which is recycling. If these are part of so many of the things that we commonly use, how easy are they to recycle? And are we also seeing the Chinese have cornered that market by taking all of our waste electronics to recycle and have these very toxic locations in China where this is occurring?
That's a very interesting question, Tom. Let us pick it up. Tony Mariano, I mean, one problem with recycling, as I understand it, is that even in products, these are very widely dispersed. It's something like a penny's worth of some rare earth element in a cell phone that allows you to put it on vibrate. Is recycling a way to get at this?
I think there has been research conducted in this area, but I don't know that there is any source of recycled rare earths. They occur in many devices in very small quantities, and it's very complex because they are inextricably associated with many other elements, and the cost of isolating the individual rare earths in the recycling process could be very expensive. That's not my field, but...
It sounds pretty tough. They're so widespread. Christine, Congress is suddenly focused on this. Last week, the House passed legislation. What would it do?
I'd provide loan guarantees to folks like Molycorp, who may be able to bring some production online. But I think there's also measures in there to provide funding for research and development. For, again, looking into recycling might be way too uneconomical to get into that, but how to better and more efficiently produce them and mill them. And one thing that's important, particularly if you look at things like permanent magnets, we've been able to improve the processes and efficiencies of using rare earths over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So permanent magnets in jet engines, for example, are much smaller than they used to be to have the same effect. So we're already using these more efficiently than we used to, increasing the efficiency as much as possible where we still have the ability to do that is going to be part of the answer. Recycling, again, is going to probably be too pricey. But again, this is going to be a foreign policy problem. It takes 15 years or even 5 to 10 years to get new production online from the United States or Australia or other partners. It puts the weight on our diplomats and those conducting our foreign policy to ensure that the systems, that our relationships are good with countries that produce it and that our systems of trade with them are as open as possible.
You say countries that produce it, but we're really talking China. And the next, whether it's 5 or 10 or 15 years, that's a pretty critical window when all kinds of technologies are surging forward in big ways. Tom Friedman writes all the time about how the green technology race, you know, may be lost 5 seconds from now if we don't get on top of it. And these are so important in green technology. I mean, you think 10 years there, that's a pretty important time. Meanwhile, you say, Christine, that when other countries do set out to ramp up production here, China's out there very quickly trying to buy them out and maintain control. Is that right?
Yes, and they tried to do that with the territory, some of the territories in Australia that are now going up to production. And the Australian government decided to make sure that those properties did not get sold to any other countries and that they stayed a national asset. That was a strategic decision for security and foreign policy reasons, but also for their own economic competitiveness. It's up to individual countries to decide roughly what they're going to do in these fields. But again, particularly because we're in the situation we are now with China, it's going to be a foreign policy challenge and a foreign policy issue for the foreseeable future that we're just going to have to deal with.
The Australian government stepped in and disallowed a purchase in Australia, but it's a tough picture out there. Kevin, in Orlando, Florida. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi. Is this just another indication of our failed economic policy of a blind obedience to Adam Smith and free trade? Not just China, but, you know, Japan controls the significant technology that we use in our weapons. They're our buddies now, but if Japan and China decide to go it alone or if China suggests that they cut back, we're still held hostage, not by Chinese, but by the Japanese. I mean, our free trade policy has just been a disaster.
Well, I wonder about that, Christine. I mean, free trade has created a lot of wealth. You can argue about how it's been distributed. But just on the national security front here, I mean, what about it? The Pentagon, I understand, has big studies going on this as well, concerned about, as you say, they didn't even know where the elements came from that were in many of their critical weapons, may still not know exactly. What's the Pentagon view of this whole rare earth issue?
Sure. So much of that information is proprietary, and countries like Japan share information between their industries and their government much more openly and readily than we do in this country. So just having that information is going to be a huge hurdle that DOD is in the process of getting over right now. But again,
but it makes our defense look like a joke. It's fantastic, but if you don't even know where the elements came from that created it, and you have no sense of what the supply chain is, and you have no control of the supply, and we obviously don't. I mean, it's like this gigantic Pentagon sitting on top of a fiction.
Well, they've always had stockpiling programs. They've always had measures and policies to deal with this kind of thing when it happens, when it manifests in a problem, vice just a supply chain disruption or, you know, a price increase on platforms that DOD is procuring. There have been measures in place for, you know, since for at least 100 years, going back to the world wars for dealing with this.
There and have those been effective with rare earths? I mean, China, what, in July, they reduced their rare earth export quotas for the rest of the year by 72%, prices went up 6 times for some elements. Does the DOD have a stockpile of rare earth elements?
Well, the problem is that the stockpiling system for all minerals was found to be out of date. There was a National Academy study conducted a few years ago that looked at the stockpiling system and how our defense industries and defense systems keep track of these things and stockpile them and try to hedge against any problems like this. And it found that it was sufficiently out of date, given the global supply chain of the defense industries, but also their dual use. The Department of Defense now procures a lot of things that both have civilian applications and defense applications. So the entire nature of our defense supply system is different from what it was in the decades past. The minerals policies and stockpiling policies have not kept up with those changes.
You say that so nicely, but it can sound like a joke. I mean, the laser-guided U.S. smart bomb factory in Indiana is now a doggy daycare center. The factory is in China that now makes that material. I mean, that's out of date, I should say. Brian, in Windsor Locks, Connecticut. Brian, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. I have a question regarding the rare earth minerals and elements. If mining them is causing so much environmental damage, you know, how green is green? They're being used in our so-called green technology.
Yeah.
I wonder if you're...
Net, bottom line, how green is green? I mean, that's an interesting question, Tony. It may be beyond your expertise, but they're in solar panels, they're in wind turbines, they're in Priuses, 25 pounds in every Prius. But you say at the mining end, they're creating environmental havoc. So how's it net out?
They need not create an environmental problem.
Have they so far?
I don't believe they have.
In China?
Yes, in China, but in the United States.
Well, we stopped producing them.
Well, the problem in the United States and in other countries is the cost of competing with the Chinese. At the end, that's what it comes down to.
So what about the free market question that our listener raised? Is the government, U.S. government, going to have to subsidize the production of these rare earth elements in this country for the U.S. to have its own supply?
Voilà la question.
Oh, well, when we go to French, we know we're in trouble. I mean, the loan guarantees that the House is now talking about for American production, do they look sufficient to mollycord the American company? Do you have any idea to get this back up in gear? And would California want it or permit it? Can it really be clean enough?
I believe it can be, and I believe that it has not created the environmental problems that it has been accused of causing.
In this country?
In this country.
Though it has in China, you're saying?
In China, it's...
Anything
goes. It's very apparent, yeah.
What kind of problems in China?
Well, again, they're disrupting very large quantities of earth.
Well, they'll just chew up many square miles?
Yeah, and much of the material, particularly in the iron-adsorbed South China clays, most of the material ends up in the rivers. Okay, that have been disrupted.
And the effect on humans?
It's difficult to say what effect it has had on humans.
Would you drink it? Would you like to drink it?
No, not at all. I know that I've done quite a bit of work, probably as much as anyone, at Mountain Pass, California. And there are no environment. As far as I'm concerned, there are no environmental problems there.
So it could be done in this country.
That cannot be controlled, right?
But at what cost? I mean, you can't.
Okay, so
part of the cost already of going green is the environmental cost. If it costs $1 trillion to make it clean, that wind turbine is going to be awfully expensive when it comes to generating electricity.
If we are required for defense purposes to have lanthanides, We know where to get them now. It's going to be more costly for us to get them, but we do have them, both lights and heavies, at a greater cost. And part of the cost, you want to bear this in mind, it's not just the grade and tonnage of the resource, mm-hmm. but the processing costs that can be extensive. And they have to be very carefully considered. Many deposits and occurrences that are being evaluated at this time are being evaluated based on mineralogy, rare earth element distribution, grade and tonnage, but they have not worked out the processing costs that will allow them to compete on the world marketplace.
I read somewhere processing costs in China of 6 cents, I don't know what, an hour a ton, but like nothing like Americans
right.
level. Percy in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Percy, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. Can we get to our hemisphere and get away from China? And let's talk about the little country of Bolivia that I believe is sitting on 50% of the world's lithium. Is that going to be a target of the Western countries and turn that into a new banana republic? Next, I'd like the professor to talk about the space rocks that were brought back by NASA, whether or not we're going to start harvesting interstellar space rocks for rare earths and other items that are not ever going to be talked about.
Percy, let us pick it up. What about Bolivia and lithium ions? Are those rare earth elements, Tony?
No. Lithium is an independent element exclusive of the rare earth elements.
What about Western Hemisphere for rare earth elements? Are there significant supplies that the U.S. might have access to, or
yes,
does China already have them tied up?
We do have these. And as far as any deposit that's being considered as a source, it's all a question of grade and tonnage and amenability to economic recovery. If someone lands on the moon, and no one has done this on this level yet, mm-hmm. and when they walk on the surface, they find nuggets of gold and diamonds, then it's profitable, perhaps, if you have enough tonnage, to mine the moon. But at this point, we have no indication mm-hmm. that the moon would be a better source of rare earth elements than our Earth.
Kimberly in Muscatine, Iowa. Kimberly, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're all right. What do you think?
Well, I was doing some reading. This may be totally off. I know that most people are talking about the environmental issue. I'm concerned about that as well.
Yes.
But I was reading that in mid-Eastern Africa, that there were huge deposits there. I was under the impression there were a number of American companies that had staked huge claims there. Have the Chinese knocked us out of that market?
Let's see. What about rare earth elements in Africa, Tony?
I'm quite familiar with the African resources. And as a matter of fact, I feel that very comfortable about the resources on a world level. And at this time, there's nothing in East Africa that will compete with what we have in North America.
So bring it to North America. Christine, what's your sense of whether this country will figure out a way economically and environmentally to begin to produce its own rare earth elements again, and in what kind of time frame, Christine?
I think we will. Again, it's just up to a decision by Congress of whether or not they're willing to subsidize it, to provide loan guarantees, to provide financial support to it. Molycorp, for example, had an IPO recently and did not bring in as much funding as they thought because the commodity, you know, not sold as a commodity, but, you know, the minerals markets and the financial system see this as very different when they're not looking at necessarily the national security reasons. So
right.
There's no telling. If we want to, we can. It's fine. I don't think that we are going to go to Latin America and dominate other countries. I believe we get most of our lithium from Chile right now, who has a very large reserve of it. Again, this is bringing out, I think, this conversation, and particularly with legislation pending on the Hill, is bringing out protectionist tendencies and concerns that go way overboard on this. And
but Japan just learned, straight up, China, you know, whether explicitly or just with a wink, threatened to withhold rare earth elements there. Isn't that an issue for this country?
It is very problematic, but obviously there were territorial and political elements of that equation. They weren't completely centered just on the minerals question.
But, I mean, territorial and political elements, that's what makes the world go round. This is going to be really interesting. No disrespect to China. They're pursuing their national interests. But what an interesting element or elements to be right in the middle of those affairs. And we're learning a lot about them in this hour. Christine Parthamore at the Center for New American Security. Thank you very much for being with us, Christine.
Thank you.
And Anthony Mariano, geologist extraordinaire worldwide. Thank you for your insights today, Tony.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it. And I was particularly impressed, Christine, with your presentation.
Great. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.